For those of you who have seen the movie The Manchurian Candidate, you'll find this interview beyond intriguing. Dr. Nick Begich has spent the last decade investigating the use of 21st century technologies and their effects on our brain. It probably doesn't surprise you to know that technologies that produce this effect on people actually exist. Let's hear what Dr. Begich has to say about these well-cloaked technologies. As we've been talking about some of the 21st century technologies, one area that can't be ignored is that our brains are being affected by a lot of external forces, electromagnetic, radio frequencies, etc. Can you give us a little bit of background in the ways in which we're being impacted at this time?
Sure. You know, this area is we consider the most controversial area that we've covered in the last 11 years, and it's an area that I'm committing the next 5 years to educate the public around the world on, because I think it is the most important technology. The idea of interfering with the human brain, either from external sources without our consent, is a significant issue for me. In the United States, according to Secretary of Energy O'Leary, when she was in that position under the Clinton administration, she had said that over 500,000 Americans in a 40-year period had been victims of human experimentation in the United States without their consent. You know, from syphilis being given to black men in the Southeast to see how they would die over time, to radioactive iodine and inupiates in Alaska to see how they would die over time, and many, many other things. One of the most extraordinary reports came out in the early 70s during a number of congressional hearings, and there was actually a presidential report issued in June of 1975, and it was on CIA abuses within the United States, and it was a report to the president. What was contained in that was a chapter talking about mind manipulation using chemical means and programs, MKUltra and their associated programs run by the Central Intelligence Agency. And all of these things are referenced in our written work. We have hundreds and hundreds of reference sources. But when you look at what they were doing then, it was primarily chemical means. At least that's what made it into the literature. When you go back even further, if you go back to, say, the Korean era, you know, in that era we had servicemen returning from warfare, and they were exhibiting these very bizarre behaviors. These patriotic young guys were coming back and handing communist leaflets out on street corners, and this is where the term brainwashing was actually coined, was in that era. And so our government began to look, can we, you know, what did they do and can we do it too, became the equation. And so as you look all the way into the 50s and into the early 60s, these technologies were being explored. By the early 60s, we had captured a device. It was actually during the Vietnam era, and we captured a Russian device called the LIDA machine, L-I-D-A, which was actually looked at by a guy named Ross Addy, one of the leading researchers, again, for military. He looked at this, and it was used for putting military prisoners of war into trance-like states using flickering lights and sound and electromagnetic field oscillations, so that you would get in a very relaxed state, in a state where they could extract intelligence much more efficiently from you. And that became a whole new review for military technologists in this country, thinking maybe we can use electromagnetic fields to manipulate what's going on in the brain. In 1969, there was a book published called Towards a Psycho-Civilized Society, and this was put together by Jose Delgado, and he had his doctorate in electrophysiology from the University of Madrid from 1950. He came over to Yale University in the mid-60s and began mapping the human brain, stimulating the human brain in primates and bulls and animals, all different kinds of animals, stimulating different parts of the brain to see what parts were responsible for what kinds of actions or cognitive functions and so on. So what he was doing in those days, in the 60s, was he was implanting microcircuits, and then, or not microcircuits, circuits, and stimulating them with RF, radio frequency energy. So one of the illustrations or photographs shows a charging bull coming at him, and he throws the switch, and the bull stops right in front of him. Well, by the mid-80s, he figured out you didn't need any implanted technologies. All you needed to know was how to modulate the right frequency, and the energy density, the concentration of energy, was 1/50th of what the Earth naturally produces. Very small energy in the RF range, radio frequency ranges. Now compare that to what's around us right at the moment. At the moment, there's 200 million times more radio frequency and energy around us in any urban area than there is naturally produced by the Earth. So a huge amount, and out of all that background noise, what he found is, by hitting a precise window frequency with very low energy concentrations, you would pick that signal out because it was coherent, not like nature all over the map. It was a coherent rhythmic signal in a very precise frequency. The brain would pick it out, and he could change behavior from lethargic to highly active, back and forth, like switching on and off a light switch.
Let me ask a question right here. Is that with a subject that was in, say, a short distance of whatever he was utilizing to affect this particular pulse, or is this at large? Could he do this on, say, larger groups?
You could do it on an individual basis or a very large basis. In fact, if you go back to the work of J.F. Gordon McDonald, he was a geophysicist at UCLA, and he was a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson. He wrote a chapter in a book called Unless Peace Comes, and the chapter was called How to Wreck Your Environment. But within that chapter was a section that said, if we could ever learn how to electronically stroke the ionosphere, this layer that begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface that's electrically charged, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke it, he said, to get it to send a signal back to the Earth, we could affect the behavior of people over huge geographic areas on a hemispheric basis. And it wouldn't affect everyone. It would affect 70 or 80% of the population is what they more or less figured. But this was a technology that didn't exist in 1969. In the early 70s, Zbigniew Brzezinski referenced J.F. Gordon's work and said, you know, this is a technology that will likely emerge. What has happened with a project that I wrote a book on some time ago, Angels Don't Play This Harp, about the HARP project, it was designed to do many things. As a side effect or a deliberate effect, this can happen. You know, I mean, the fact is they generate the right kind of signal in the right range to override brain function. And that you can kind of look at the brain in sort of this way, in terms of predominant brain activity. 1 to 4 hertz or pulses or vibrations per second, this is where you are in your deepest, deepest states of sleep. The next range, approximately 4 to 7 hertz, this is the theta range, this is where you are between awake and asleep, when you're consciously aware of your dreams. This is where little kids are between 3 and 6 years old, why they have trouble distinguishing reality from imagination, because of the way the brain works at that time. A little bit further up, you have the alpha range, 7 to say 11, 12 hertz in that range. This is where you are when you're in the zone, when you're doing your art, your reading, your research, when you're really focused. You know, that's where you want to be. And then above that is the beta ranges, where people should be when we're actively having this kind of a dialogue. And then high beta is where you are in your agitated states. If you think about affecting the brain by analogy, similarly to dialing a radio station. You know, when you dial through the radio station, most of the energy is just static. You're static between the stations. When you get on station, you get resonance, harmony between the transmitter and receiver, and you get a nice clear signal. The same is true in the human body and the human brain. Whether you look at it on an elemental level, the elements that compose the body, or you take it all the way up to the organs of the body, you can create modulations, oscillations that will override the brain's natural rhythms. The brain will entrain or lock onto that external signal and begin to mirror it.
By putting this coherent signal in.
Right. Coherent, meaning rhythmic,
right.
Not random.
Right.
And so it's not so much the amount of energy, it's the way the energy is manipulated. And so what they found in military applications, and there's dozens of source documents that we quote, they found that they could use these external fields for degrading or depleting the ability of an adversary to, say, wage war or confuse their thoughts enough to where they become...
And this was actually utilized.
Yeah, these technologies have been around. They've been tested over the years. The question becomes is where and when, and under what classifications. And as we looked at them, and we saw over almost three dozen U.S. patents showing the evolution of these technologies cited in our work, you know, this is all material that is in the open literature. When you trace the history, you can go back to, say, the early 80s even, where they began to ask for what's called dosimetry handbooks, dosages of radio frequency necessary to override various parts of the body, whether it be the brain, the heart, the liver, the lungs. By 85, the United States Air Force contracted with the University of Utah and actually put together the Radio Frequency Dosimetry Handbook, which is a big, thick volume that lays it out so that you can target the heart, the liver, the lungs, or the brain, or any other organ of the body to debilitate an adversary, or to stop their heart and kill them, for that matter. You know, recently you've seen promoted, in fact, it's been every year for 5 years, they announced it as if it were brand new, this Humvee with a dish on the back of it that's used for riot control purposes. And the story goes it'll create the heat sensation on the surface of the body of about 130 degrees, which it certainly will do if it's ranged correctly. If it's ranged for, say, a half a mile and someone walks 20 feet in front of it, they're going to have a much different experience than 130 degrees on the surface of the skin. But, you know, in civil societies, we gave up burning people at the stake a long time ago, and now we have and now we have a technological application that doesn't create the same stench of flames affecting tissue, but has the same dramatic torturing effect. And this is used for not just foreign adversaries. This was funded also for domestic riot control purposes. And what they didn't tell the public is, by changing the waveform, pulse rate, frequency, or any number of parameters, you can have a much, much different effect. You can affect the brain, the heart, the liver, the lungs. You can do many, many things with the very same device driven by software and the push of a button. And it's a question of the intent of the operator. But you introduce a new piece of hardware, you have to have the story. And the story for the military is, it's just for heating. And I believe it's a lie, because the technology is there, and they would apply that technology, if not experimentally, as they're doing in the war fronts that we're engaged in today, to see what and how far they can go with these technologies.
These same technologies, might this go back even to, say, the days of Royal Rife, when he was using his, quote, energy technologies or frequency technologies to target a particular bacteria or organ in the body and help enhance the health of it? Is this not, perhaps, is this a more sophisticated but potential or version of that, except with negative applications?
Absolutely. You know, energy medicine is where the hope lies. You know, this is where the hope is to move from the chemical models to the electromagnetic models. You know, when you think about, you know, that transition, now you hear a little bit of movement because everybody talks about electrochemical models. You know, it's underlying all of the chemistry. And if you look at how the biological sciences evolved, you know, people that had really good training and talent in mathematics tend to go to the physics side of life. People that couldn't quite get the math but were very brilliant tended to move towards chemistry and the life sciences. And they kind of parted the waters there, which was a serious mistake, because all chemical activity has an underlying energetic on the physics level. You can do things here that then create changes in the chemistry. And this is where the disconnect that I think has been, if you look at the papers that have been published in the last, say, 10 years, you see these things coming together as people understand that the underlying energetic exchanges have an impact on molecules and chemicals that then manifest themselves in health maladies. So consequently, if you think about how Westerners approach medicine, we kind of look from the outside in. You look at the physical body, we might do some blood tests, we might do some imaging, but we don't do much more than that. If you think about Eastern medicine, it starts from an energetic level and works outward. It takes a little longer. You know, things like acupuncture that are quite controversial in the past have been quantified. You know, there's a device that we demonstrate that actually where you can actually locate the points by measuring skin resistance differentials on the surface of the skin. You find all the acupuncture points.
Well, even HMOs are now supporting payment of acupuncture in some of these.
Because it works.
Right.
And it works profoundly without the chemicals that can damage liver and kidneys and the rest of our physiology.
So it's not the technology itself certainly is not evil.
No.
It is simply being used in ways that are perhaps not for the highest and best good of all at times. And just to wrap up that element of it, how does one even know if these technologies are being used or if they're being subject to these technologies?
You don't. That's the problem. There's no regulation. There's no way to really tell as an individual. You would just assume it was you. You know.
Are there some signatures in how you would behave or feel or anything like that?
Well, I mean, you'd feel obviously out of character, but again, you know, people go through periods where they do that. You know, you might feel confused. Some people would probably think they were losing mental faculties, you know, that it was themselves. Nobody, very few, would ever suggest that it's something else. Now, we hear from people all the time that assert that military is doing this to them, and most of those folks are having other problems. But I am sure that just based on the fact that our government's history in this area and them being caught a number of times in this area, you know, these experiments go on. And the fact is, if it doesn't happen within the boundaries of the United States, it happens somewhere else where they feel the Constitution doesn't apply.
So is it a blurry line between experimenting on, you said, 500,000 people over the course of the last few decades and who might have been involved in the military or something, feeling they had an empirical right because these were employees of sorts or groups that they felt they had an advantage over,
isn't it a fuzzy line to determining who else is going to be subject to it?
Oh, ultimately, you know, ultimately when you start looking at all these technologies, you know, who are the targets? You know, the targets are obviously declared adversaries. But when you think about it, and again, going back to this kind of technology evolving, the temptation of political leaders is to get their views across, to get their issues pushed forward, not because they don't believe in them, quite the contrary. They believe vigorously in them. Would they use technology? I think so. Zbigniew Brzezinski thinks so, and he's said so. You know, the fact is, when you think about the invasiveness of this technology, think about the basic values Americans hold in common, think about the very First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech, assembly, religion, are all predicated on one idea, freedom to think. The fact that we have technologies that can interfere with that today demands regulation as a fundamental to the American character.
Let's take it a step further. These technologies can also be used in a positive way to enhance our brain's functioning. And let's look at some of the positive applications.
This is the most important, absolutely. And in the fact that the government withholds so much data that could be useful to the life sciences has not stopped advances from being made. A good example is neurobiofeedback or brain biofeedback used for treating ADD, attention deficit disorder, children, hyperactive kids as well, stroke victims, addictive behaviors. And what they use is an 8 or 16 channel EEG, so they have, you know, it's kind of messy, gooey stuff all over your head. Well, they got new ones now. They're nice little helmets that you can wear. And you look at a computer screen, and in real time, you might see, like for a little kid, a bouncing ball or a guy running a foot race. And the idea is to get the guy to win the race. And what they're really doing is training their own brains to fall into that range, that ideal range of learning. And so what happens, in Minneapolis School District, they did this with a charter school. And they took all the kids in there, they were all on Ritalin and other psychoactive drugs. They went through 30 to 41 hour sessions of this kind of training, put the hardware aside, and they were off. 80% of the kids were off of those drugs. By the end of the first year, integrated back into regular ed programs. You can't say enough about what that did for those children, but think about it from everyone's standpoint. It costs two or three or four times more per year, every year, to educate those kids otherwise in special education programs. If you can avoid that, this is a tremendous step in the right direction, and it's just one. Other areas where this technology has been advanced is light and sound devices. You know, these ideas that create a flickering light that the brain entrains to, and people go, well, how can a little flickering light do that? Do you remember a few years ago in Japan when 700 kids went to the hospital with epileptic seizures from watching a cartoon? Now, it wasn't the energy concentration, because it's quite light. I mean, you put your hand up next to a color television set, you feel static. You get back just an inch or two, and it's gone. Well, 10 feet away, they say it's perfectly safe. It was the flicker rate, the frequency, that window frequency of coherent energy that was sufficient to cause that chemical cascade in those 700 kids that led to epileptic seizures. Now, flickering light has been shown to do many things in terms of entrainment, but you can entrain to levels that get you into those deep states of meditative states. You can entrain for relaxation, for sleep. You can entrain to energize when you're a little bit lethargic, or you can entrain for specific learning applications. And so these technologies are out there. When you think about electromedicine as a concept, electroacupuncture, electrolaser acupuncture has been developed and licensed in Europe, meeting challenges in Finland all the way to the highest court. A good friend of mine, Reho Mikaela, before he passed away, took on that challenge. He treated 16,000 people with a method of electrolaser acupuncture. He was challenged by the medical authorities in Finland all the way to their high courts, and he won. There are 15 trained clinicians there providing this technology and expanding it. These are the things that really offer not the Pandora's box of the military, but the real hope for many, many people. When you think about stroke victims' recovery and being able to get back some of those faculties, I mean, all of us have met people or known people who've lived any length at all that could use this technology, and the fact is, it's not in the mainstream. Only a few school districts, after being around for now 20 years, some of this stuff are integrating it. Some of the medicine that you're seeing now in terms of acupuncture moving into some of these other areas is just now starting to get into the mainstream, although it's been around now for a couple of decades. It takes time. The biggest loss, the biggest criminal element, is the idea that all the millions, all the billions that we spend in military research is withheld from the public for the health advantages that might be offered by the understanding of these types of technologies. Mm.
And sound technology, you were talking about flickering lights. There are incredible advancements in sound technology, and one that I've had a little bit of exposure to that I think is just fabulous and simple is the HemiSync.
Yeah, HemiSync was developed by Bob Monroe, and it's one of those technologies we were pretty excited about, and we've been excited about for a long time. And what it creates is whole brain coherence, where the whole brain actually resonates to that input signal. And here's the thing about hearing, you know, for using sound, it's a little tough because to get those low frequency, extremely low frequency signals, you know, we don't hear that low. So what Monroe figured out is that by sending a signal in, say, one ear at, say, 16,000 hertz or vibrations per second, one in at, say, 16,007, they cancel and leaves a beat frequency of 7 that the brain locks onto. And as it locks onto it, both hemispheres' energy distribution is about even. In other words, if you looked at it, just a normal brain activity, you'd see usually a lot of energy concentrated in one area of the brain on one side and the other kind of dead, or vice versa. And there's this big argument, right brain, left brain, one's creative, one's analytical, and which is more important? They're both important and meant to work together. What HemiSync does is create that entrainment of both hemispheres where they both are working together, and then they have specific CDs that are designed to affect different things. So whether it's behavior modification, they use in some cases just straight tones. Other cases they use tones with suggestion. And the difference is their suggestions are audible. You can hear them all. They're not like subliminals, which can be quite dangerous. And the reason subliminals can be dangerous is word symbols are very, very powerful. If I say dog, for instance, some people feel real good about it. Others get gripped with fear because of experiences they've had with animals. So when you listen to subliminals and you don't know what's being said, remember these are bypassing the conscious. So if they conflict with your value system, conflicts in value systems at the subconscious level is the root of many forms of psychosis. So you want to know what's being put in. So HemiSync I like because if they use words, and in some they do, you know exactly what words are going to be used. They line up with your value systems or you don't use them.
And then the one I'm particularly fond of that I use to sit down and write a script and do my research, well, through my iPod little headset, is one that has no words in it and you don't really hear the tone. It's more just sounds like really pretty music.
Right.
Very pleasant music, except you feel incredibly uplifted and optimistic.
Right.
And your brain is incredibly focused.
Yeah, and these are exactly what they're designed to do. I mean, there's several designed for concentration for those kinds of applications. There's some designed for memory, relaxation, getting rid of bad habits, losing weight, increasing sex drive. I mean, it goes on and on and on. They have lots of material out there. And they're cheap. I mean, that's the beauty of it. It's not like you got to invest hundreds and hundreds of dollars. These are things that cost $20. And a CD lasts as long as the CD lasts, and there you are. You have something that you can apply to your specific need as an individual making the choice, not having it imposed upon you, and then utilize it to enhance your own performance. And in a technological age, we need more of that. And the nice thing about it is the more you use these technologies, the brain lays down its own pathways. And so your tendency is, on a more frequent basis, you do it naturally. You know, with little kids, you see a lot more balance. As we bring them into so-called education, we see this shift where we treat little girls one way and little boys another way, and as a consequence, one brain gets developed, one side of the brain versus the other. Today, a little less of that because we kind of mess them up equally nowadays. But the point is, by the end of high school, there's very little brain coherence with both hemispheres working together. Very rarely do you see that. And this is something that we need more of, things that could be easily integrated into public education, but could most certainly be integrated privately. The thing about public education that's extremely important is as technologies evolve, the way this is headed in the direction in which military sees it going is you'll be actually able to transfer full memory sets. They believe they're going to be able to model the brain in the next 10 to 15 years, where if you want to learn a language instead of spending years doing it, you could download that language and have it in a few hours. Now that is not science fiction today. I mean, that is the leading directions of many researchers today.
How does that change the educational system?
Very important, because remember, education in the United States is compulsory, required in most states until you're 16. Parents don't set the curriculum. Government does. For learning language, which is kind of neutral, that's one thing. Or mathematics, which is kind of neutral. What about social studies? You know, what about social values? What's normal? What's right? What's wrong? Who's going to decide that? And the problem is, as these systems evolve in an environment of compulsory education, you don't get a choice. You get a scripted menu of someone else's system, And is that appropriate? Who should set values for children, parents or governmental agencies? I don't care whether you're a liberal or a conservative, everyone agrees it's parents. And those that don't are sorely, sorely mistaken. The fact of the matter is, as the technologies evolve, we need more choice in education for parents to exercise where their kids eventually get their downloads. And it's going to be this generation that decides. And that means that we have to begin to educate ourselves as the technologies evolve, not once they arrive. And I think that's the challenge. I mean, for us, for the next 5 years, this area is so important because we know it takes about 20 to 25 years to migrate out of those military-industrial complex into the private sector, so we right now have time to make that difference. And I think it's a wonderful challenge, because if we can look at these technologies from our own individual value set and expand what we're capable of as human beings, great, great things are possible for humanity. We were designed to use the whole brain. Now we have technologies that can help us get there, and we should do that.
If you're interested in these exotic and little-known technologies, you'll likely find the interview with Jerry E. Smith quite an eye-opener. Meanwhile, visit Dr. Begich's site for more information. Until next time, thanks for watching.